Welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. On today's episode, I'm speaking with Mark Sainsbury about regenerative farming, Canned Over Brook sparkling wine, and his perception of luxury. Mark, thank you for joining us on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. I wanted to start, as I always do, by asking my guest about them, how they started doing what they do.
Well, I guess to end up at winemaking, you've got to start with food for me. I went through school without a clue as to what I wanted to do. And like a lot of my contemporaries, I took a year out between school and university. And with the intention of learning a bit of French, I headed off to Paris and I signed up to a cookery school called La Varenne in the 7th in Paris. It's not there anymore, but I had just a formative experience. The happiest time in my life up until that point, learning the French traditional method of cooking. And we would cook all morning, sit down and eat the food. And then in the afternoon, spend our times learning about French cheeses and wines and the whole gastronomy. And in one kind of 6-week period, I realized what it is that I wanted to do. And that was to revolve my life around food and hospitality. And so for the next 30 years, the project was one of a particular emphasis on restaurants and ending up in hotels. So with my great friend Sam and Sam Clark, we set up Morrow Restaurant in 97, which to this day is this wonderful institution of Spanish and North African gastronomy. And once that was set up, I went off and set up the Zeta Group. And with my partner there, Michael Bennion, we had 15 really happy years opening hotels and partnering with chefs and realizing that dream of creating exciting spaces in which people enjoy and celebrate great food and wine. And then about towards the end of that chapter, back in 2010, I think, my dad, who was kind of 9 years retired, came to me and said, "I've had an idea. How about you and your brother Julian join me in a project? I wanna plant a vineyard." And so when your dad, you know, somebody of that stature and that level of success, with whom I really hadn't worked at all apart from a bit of time at setting up Zeta, comes to you with a proposition like that, you don't refuse that. And absolutely, it chimed with my own kind of passions around wine that had built up over those kind of 30 years of hospitality. And knowing that we happened to be, that our family farm happened to be on, the right chalk, the same chalk indeed, the chalk seam that runs through Champagne. And knowing that we had the perfect south-facing slopes and indeed had enough friends around to help us guide us in those early years where we were feeling our way with the technical know-how of which clones and which varieties to plant. Like I say, it was an offer I couldn't refuse.
So where's the interest in food come from?
Well, I mean, my surname is Sainsbury.
Yes.
And so the clue's in the name, I guess.
Right,
you know,
okay.
So we grew up in a foodie family.
Yeah.
We've always had wonderful housekeepers and chefs cooking for us. So I remember back to some formative meals where just the experience of that exquisite taste, really moved me emotionally. My mum tells a story. We were celebrating her birthday at the Gavroche, and I had that one of the it was a lobster ravioli. And I mean, it literally brought a tear to my eye. Yeah. And you know, I just think the enjoyment I get from it is something that I want to share with others. And there's something in my genes about convening, about hosting, about kind of opening one's home and creating spaces and occasions that make people happy. I'm a people pleaser, I think I would be described as. And that sits very comfortably, the hospitality sits right at the heart of that, of kind of generous spirit and just getting pleasure from making people happy.
Yeah, and why not? I mean, that's the best pleasure to get.
Yeah.
Do you cook?
I cook. In fact, I spent my first few years thinking I was going to be a chef. So through having done that course in my year out, I spent my university years kind of cooking grand dinner parties and kind of puffing myself up as a kind of future chef. And then after post uni, I went back to France, and I was a stagiaire in a 2-star Michelin restaurant in Tours. And it was an extraordinary experience because actually they had a very mechanistic approach to food. The French hierarchy of the kitchen, all the creativity was just one person, so the head chef. Everything else was mechanical and repeated. So I spent 3 weeks doing the same Julien of carrots, and it was like, oh my goodness, I don't want this any part of this. And so it put me off. I didn't at that time know that there are two very different types of kitchen. There's the kind of French style with the brigade and the systematic approach, and there's the more, well, I think of it as a more kind of feminine style of kitchen, where it's, you know, a changing menu every day in a more kind of Mediterranean style, rough around the edges and a bit more creative. If maybe I wouldn't have given up on chefing if I'd known that, but that was enough to put me off. And so I thought, I'll go front of house. And my friend Samantha, who I was plotting our restaurant plans with, she was blossoming as a restaurant, as a chef. And it was a very easy kind of segue to go, well, you be the chef, I'll go maitre d'.
Right, okay. So 15 years ago was the hotel, Rosetta.
Yeah.
Why did you decide that wasn't for you?
Well, so the end of Zeta.
Yeah.
It must have been kind of 14, 15 years of a real great success. And that, to the extent that we were being approached by different developers and with opportunities. And we made the mistake of choosing one developer who was doing this incredible building up in Manchester. And we poured our soul for 2 years into the design of this, what would have been an extraordinary hotel. Which on the back of some financial crisis of the developers fell through. Mm. And we at the same, both my partner and I had the same reaction. It's like, well, if we're not moving forward, we're going backwards. And actually, are we enjoying it as much as we can? And might we get, you know, quite a good offer? So we set about selling it. But it was, I guess it was also a reflection of the kind of evolution of my own motivations, I think. Mm. Because much as, you know, you spend your 20s and 30s trying to prove yourself to your contemporaries and your parents and, you know, kind of making a splash, actually that changed over time, for me, as it does with many people. And it was less about making it in business, and it was more about making a difference. Yeah. And by that, I mean, actually kind of running one's businesses in harmony with one's principles. So I spend a lot of time thinking about our philanthropic trust and giving money to worthy causes, in my case around sustainability and climate change in most part. And it became more and more difficult to justify what was, it was a well-meaning hotel with lots of nice sustainable projects, but it began to feel like a distraction and not close enough to the principles that guided the rest of my life.
Right. Tell us about the philanthropic work around.
Well, listen, it's a source of great pride. It's a trait that runs throughout the family. I don't know how it happens, but every single one of my cousins and my uncles and my parents, and back at 2 or 3 generations, we've always felt a sense of responsibility towards society in terms of giving something back, and what makes, I mean, that's an easy thought to have, but putting that into practice can be a real challenge, particularly if you haven't got any advisors. But what I was hugely lucky to have is the family philanthropic office, mm-hmm. through which we all do our giving, and within which there's this extraordinary tradition and expertise around giving. Be that, you know, to the arts, like my parents spend a lot of time doing, or in my case, sustainability and climate change and food, sustainable food systems. There is an extraordinary kind of support network there. So it was obviously to that I turned to do it. And over the years, it's evolved. We started very traditionally, as many do, writing checks for kind of average 3-year term to these kind of a revolving door of brilliant charities. And then we took stock about 10 years ago as to the way in which we did that and turned to a model that I'd seen in Scotland, an amazing venture philanthropy model that an organization called Inspiring Scotland had established. And that is, it's almost like a private equity model where we strike up longer term relationships with a smaller stable of charities across a range of different areas and bring them together on a regular basis, convene them, get them to swap ideas, bring interesting talks and experts to them, and go beyond, as I said, kind of call it, beyond the checkbook. So it's more than just writing a check every year. It's about that community that we forge and the expertise within the Sainsbury Family Trust's office that we can bring to bear. Mm. And it's so, for me, it's been so much more rewarding. Because you get to know them, and they drop their guard because they know you're with them for the long term. There's a different type of conversation that goes on, and one much more open and honest, and we can, you know, the admitting of their failings as well as their successes, and I love that because then we can really help and get under the bonnet and bring our expertise to bear.
And so where do you feel it's had most impact within the environment?
So what, I mean, there's a few kind of key bits where I feel most proud. I'll highlight three. So Henry Dimbleby is a great friend, and he was commissioned to do a report on school food. And come up with a school food plan, and in the early part was very reliant on philanthropic money to do the research and get and make the case. And we were, I think, one of two major donors for that. So that transformed the way that food is served, in particularly in primary schools, and the way that cooking is taught within schools, and addressed to me what I think is one of our fundamental challenges as a society in terms of our relationship with food and our understanding and appreciation of it. So I was really pleased and proud to play such an early stage in that. I went kind of around the same time as we were changing the model of our giving, I became aware of the Divest Invest movement, which started in the campuses of in the States, with students campaigning against the endowments of their colleges and investing in fossil fuels. Institutions like universities and also faith groups, whose whole reason for being is the future of future generations. They couldn't agree with the idea of them profiting off those companies that are driving us to climate disaster. Mm. And so that piqued our interest, and we were inspired by this amazing woman, Helen Dorsey, from the Wallace Global Fund, who came and talked to us as a family. And there was this extraordinary moment where I just realized the importance of that message. And actually, in first part, got my own house in order, because at that point, we were not thinking about it deeply enough. But beyond, once we did that, we then set about setting up that campaign in Europe. And so with my sister's help and brother's help, we set up Europeans for Divest Invest and enjoyed the most extraordinary success, convincing now 80% of British universities and the Church of England and the Catholic Church in the UK to commit to divest of fossil fuels, and just bringing the point to the kind of public consciousness that you cannot be concerned about the future of our planet whilst at the same time profiting from those people driving us towards disaster. And then the third thing that I'm most proud of is a court case that we brought on the back of that project, again, where we appealed against the Charity Commission, whose advice we deemed to be completely outdated around this area, of in particular how charities are allowed to invest their endowments. Because our judgment was it was far too easy for those charities, not thinking about it, to at the same time as giving money to, for example, cancer charities, to be invested in tobacco companies, or equally trying working on sustainability whilst invested in BP. And we changed the law through the Butler Sloss judgment. It is now impossible for charities not to think about it. It's not that they can't invest, but they have to have gone through a process whereby they and they have a policy to explain why they do. So it's not you can divest if you want to. It's you should divest unless you've got a very good reason not to. Yeah. And that's you know, forevermore, that has changed the conversation in boardrooms and with fund managers. And so I'm very proud of that.
And that was quite a famous court case.
Yeah,
I mean, I remember.
Yeah, so I work a lot with my sister. She's my elder sister, and she has dedicated her life to this area. So it's entirely befitting that the court case should be in her name.
Yeah.
But the truth is, it was my idea. So right. When we got to about within a week of the court case, and our amazing barristers turned to us and said, "Well, we've decided to call it the Butler Sloss rather than the Sainsbury yeah. court case because." My sister's mother-in-law is a famous judge.
Yeah.
I slightly struggled. That's my younger brother. It's like, but it was my idea. Anyway, I'm over it now, right. As you can tell.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
We'll repeat that in a couple of years' time, yeah. Conversation. Tell us about the Sustainable Restaurant Association that you set up yeah. in 2011.
So it was... very much co-founded with my really good friend Giles Gibbons, who, like my sister, dedicated his life to kind of sustainability and climate, and thinks very deeply about how to get businesses embracing the challenge. And it started by over a series of conversations over, I mean, I think all of them over a very nice lunch in London, and. Where he started trying to get out of me what was needed, because I had been grappling with Morrow with our own challenges about sourcing and our energy, our water footprint, and the way we treated our staff, thinking about it, but struggling because there was no kind of framework out there. There was no one stop shop of expertise anyway. So he and I began talking. And it emerged from those conversations that it might be a worthwhile and valuable thing to set up a specialist food service accreditation organization, whereby you could, you know, as a member, you could tap into specific and tailored advice for restaurants and food service businesses mm-hmm. around all a wide kind of a kind of broad church of sustainability topics. Like I say, from the way you pay tips to your staff, to how you think about your energy footprint, to the way you source your ingredients, to how you engage with your local community, and how you talk about those good things that you're doing. Mm. And so we started off, you know, it was hugely ambitious, and my trust played a pivotal role in funding those early years, and for 12 years hence. But member by member, bit by bit, we got more and more restaurants signing up, and our advice and our expertise grew, and it is a source of huge pride again that we now have a global reach. We're working in 57 different countries. We've got thousands of restaurant members, and we're changing the way people think about food.
Mm. That's interesting, because I mean, the podcast's about luxury. I wonder whether that's a luxury experience for those people who are engaging with it, because so many people don't have access to sustainable food sources.
Yes. So, I mean, I think it's an interesting interplay between sustainability and luxury. Mm. And I think these days, luxury is having to rethink itself, if one could say that, mm-hmm. in the light of the new paradigm, right?
Yeah.
That the idea of a sneaker made by a 13-year-old in Bangladesh, but having with a Louis Vuitton label on it, being a luxury item, it doesn't sit well.
No.
And so, what does that mean? Well, to me, luxury. I mean, luxury means different things to different people, but to me, there is an element by which it's about sitting comfortably with one's own values, and that the reassurance that a product is exactly in line with one's own high standards and beliefs, ethos. So there's an element, I think, kind of philosophically of a kind of alignment of principles in luxury that I think is perhaps new. But then obviously there are other elements to it, and the craft of it, the kind of artisanal mindset, where it's more than just offering value. It's about offering love and care and obsessive attention to detail. And I think that human side of luxury, where you're talking about the kind of tradition and the care and that love and the craft of it, I think that's right, in terms of the way I think of it, that's at its core.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to speak to you, because I thought we'd be aligned on the way we think about things, even though that shouldn't be the excuse to talk to you. Anyway, no, but it's interesting because one thinks about salmon farming, yeah, for example, and how, well, bad for the environment it is, and how we're encouraged to eat salmon, for example. And there's so little natural salmon around, you know, and the people that have access to that salmon are typically buying it from a supermarket, don't understand the supply chain.
Yeah.
And how important is the supply chain to you?
So, well, I mean, the relationship with suppliers, particularly in kind of during my restaurant days, was not just important, but it was just one of the most pleasurable aspects of the whole project. Because you get to meet these wonderful, quirky, in kind of creative, brilliant, obsessive people, yeah, that are just so passionate about what they do. And so to the extent that you can seek those out and really champion those and bring, you know, and help those in terms of finding routes to market for those kind of folk, I think that, you know, it's a wonderful thing. And so, you know, Sam, my great friend Sam Clark, you know, we were talking last night, we were doing a little cookery demo about that, you know, and he was echoing those words, that the idea that, you know, the small scale day boats out of Cornwall, you know, rather than the big salmon kind of industrial farming up in Scotland, that we gravitate towards those, small, you know, organic veg growers from whom, you know, Morrow buys directly. That's where, you know, it's seeking out those passionate individuals and helping them, you know, make sense of their business models. I get very excited about that. If we're bringing it to the wine, well, we grow our own grapes. We are our own, you know, producer in a way. So it's the supply chains for us are much shorter there. And for us, it's about the passion we bring to bear to how we grow the grapes and finding the right people to work with who share in that.
So with Canova Brook,
yeah,
I mean, there's a regenerative farming approach, isn't there?
Yeah.
Explain to us how that works.
I've been on lots of journeys on the hospitality journey and this the wine one, but in parallel with my winemaking journey, it's been our family farms, and around the same time as we planted the vines here, we took in hand our family farm that previously had been farmed. Industrially is the best way of talking about it. Highly intensive, just loads of chemicals and just very commercial without a moment's thought about the nature working with nature. And so we took that in hand and inherited a mess. And with the extraordinary guidance and inspiration of our farm manager, Craig, who I'm hoping you might meet later, we've been on this journey, turning the farm regenerative. And that what that means, and there's lots of different aspects to the regen, but essentially the principle is one of working with nature and help and kind of getting out of the way of nature, so for nature to do its wonderful things and tuning our farming methods to how nature would do it, and it's more specifically that's about thinking about the soil, leaving the soil as undisturbed as possible, feeding the soil with constant cover, be that those crops or cover crops which we don't harvest but are there capturing the sunlight, turning it into sugars, feeding the biology in the soil. It's about and then a much longer rotation in the farm. This is we now have instead of a 3-year rotation, it's a 7, 8, 9 year rotation. And so what we've seen in quite quick time, within 2 or 3 years, is this extraordinary transformation in the way in our resilience and our yields, but particularly our profitability. So instead, you know, we're spending less than half now on our inputs, our sprays, and enjoying, you know, it's rare you come across it, but we've kind of got a kind of quadruple win. You know, we're benefiting the soil carbon, so we're carbon negative. Wow. Biodiversity has and the nature has sprung back. We've seen more profitability than we've ever enjoyed, and we have a team on a human scale that is so much more motivated and happy in what they do because they're on this kind of mission with us. Mm. And you know, in my philanthropic life, we're often looking for maybe one or two of those at any one time. I've never come across a project that where you can get all four. And so that's a long answer to your question around the vineyard, because although there are certain different demands and the vines, the varieties we have, you know, at times are, you know, particularly when it's a very wet summer, there are times that we have to spray so we have a crop at the end of October. We adopt the same principles as we do in the farm that surrounds the vineyard, and so that is again to obsess about the soil, functioning soils, because that the dance that goes on between the roots of a vine or a wheat a crop, and the fungi in the soil, the mycorrhizal fungi and the microbiome that is the soil microbiome, is an extraordinary one. I was one of my lockdown obsessions was reading endless books, Merlin Sheldrake's Entangled Life, and Nicole Masters' For the Love of Soil, and I've got quite geeky with that whole. And it is just, it's a natural miracle that the conversations, and they are conversations that go on between plants, the mycorrhizae and the microbiome, is extraordinary. And the exchange that goes on. And so we're trying to get out of the way of that. Because as soon as you fertilize and over-fertilize, that just breaks down, that conversation, that exchange. And so if that breaks down, then the soil is just an inert substrate that will die, and we're seeing that globally in a terrifying rate.
I'm just thinking about the luxury thing again, and just going back to what you were saying about factories and kids, you know, working in factories. But this environment strikes me as being one that personifies what luxury should be, because you're so concentrated on doing good and enhancing the craftsmanship, the innovation, the alchemy, all of that at such a high level.
I agree. And it's, there's a part of me, you know, when I've been working with Sam and Sam or Bruno Lube at the restaurant, and in this case, you know, Samuel in the vineyard and our partners in the winemaking, I'm humble. I'm no great expert. But what I love is giving these brilliant folk license to do their absolute best and without any constraint around the commerciality of it. Because that all comes, I think that's what I've found certainly with my hospitality, is if you go into these things thinking about your bottom line, it comes across in the experience. But if you go in with a spirit of generosity, And I don't think, luxury doesn't make you think of generosity, but to me, it's right in there. The sense of generosity that you're going that extra mile in delivering this service, in cooking this meal or making this bottle of wine, going above and beyond what you might get away with, then I think that's another essence of luxury, is that just the extra bit. And we do that with everything we can. Here in the vineyard, you know, when we chose our clones of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier, the three varieties we have, the Champagne varieties, we chose them not for their yielding potential, we chose them for their quality. So we, compared to our neighbours, we yield 20 to 30% less. And again, try and explain that to the bank manager. He's going to look at you blankly. But to us, you know, at a year like last year, when we had the, you know, clouds and scant sunshine, we've still achieved this wonderful ripeness. We did our blending a few weeks ago, and I was astounded. And there is that sense of kind of modesty and generosity coming through, where, you know, we haven't set about, and you know, being greedy with what we're trying to do. We're just focusing on the quality, and that's also reflected in the scale that we are. We're a small vineyard, and we have no intention of growing. What my dream scenario is to find a core of customers that locally, ideally, who get what with the pro- and understand the passion that we're bringing to this project, the obsession we have with the quality of it, and every year we sell out to that group without having to try.
There are loads of things that I want to pick up on there.
Yeah.
One of them, do you call yourselves a vineyard or a wine farm?
Vineyard.
Right.
Yeah.
And why is that?
Oh, well, because the question has never even crossed my mind.
The only reason I ask is because I've spent quite a lot of time over the past few months in South Africa, and they all used to be vineyards.
Right.
And they're now wine farms.
Ooh.
And I was corrected. I said, because we stay on a wine farm, which when we last stayed there was a vineyard.
Okay.
And they've changed the language.
And what's the thinking?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I can't help you.
Sorry. But I'll log that away as a pretend. I mean, I like this. I mean, yeah. One of the core messages around our kind of brand that we love to kind of impart is that connectivity. Well, actually, connectivity generally. And I come back to that, but I guess the coherence and the consistency between the vineyard and the wider farm, the estate that surrounds it, and that we are bringing to bear the same approach and ethos in both, and that could be because I think we are doing great things throughout, and it's really I love that, and maybe we'll talk about the connectivity in a bit, but.
Yeah.
It's kind of at the heart of what we're doing in so many different ways.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I know so little. I know nothing about wine, really. And since I've started having these conversations for the podcast, it's fascinated me because the whole process in my mind personifies what luxury is, as I said earlier, around the craftsmanship and, you know, this focus on quality and on making sure that those contributing to the process have ownership, which just seems to me so important, and it's so different to the way luxury is portrayed.
Yeah,
which is fashion.
Yes, exactly. I think it's power to the artisans in a way. That's what I love. You know that we. You know, to the craftsmen and women, and to the creatives, and I mean to the point I made a moment ago. I see my role as supporting those wonderful people, the creatives, and you know when we doing the hotels. You know, the most fun we would have was sitting around the table with our interior designer and our graphic designer and our architects. Just and setting the right kind of tone to those conversations where it was genuinely a kind of collaboration of all of us chipping in and making that atmosphere work, and it's repeated again with the chefs in my restaurants and the ideas that would bubble up from our conversations and the drinks we'd have after shifts. You know, that's my sweet spot. That's what I love. Likewise, you know, with Samuel in the vineyard. What if we tried this? Why don't we go out? How would you think about that? Will you go and have a think, come back? And it's all about that challenging and conversations and giving them space and the freedom and the support financially to kind of see that vision through. I absolutely, that's where I come in.
Yeah. And they're very fortunate to have that.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that's how it feels. I mean, I do rush around a bit, so I'm not always available. So I think Samuel would complain that I'm not as present as I could be. But you know, we definitely sing from the same sheet when we're together.
Okay, talk about the connectivity you were referring to.
Oh yes, yeah. So we had like lots of brands do. You have your kind of brand Blue Sky meeting with my brother and our sales lady Amanda, and some trusted kind of friends of the brand, and you know, we batted around this sense of modern luxury and how it's not one of ostentation but authenticity, but one of the themes that kept on coming back was connection, because even just like I was talking about that dance in the soil, you know, that, you know, the way, you know, so there's a connection between our vines and the chalk and the soil and that dance of between the mycorrhizals. There's the connection between the vineyard and the wider farm and its environment. And, you know, that we're right by the brook, Canova Brook. Mm. You know, it's a very sensitive environment. It's a chalk stream. It's a kind of pristine environment with rare English white clawed crayfish. And so the way we are in our vineyard, it has a huge effect on its environment. So we have to think deeply about that. The way we're perceived by our community, the way we work with our community and talk to our community and gather around the vineyard at various times is a really important thing. And then connection is right at the heart of what we hope our product helps people do, right? So when you're not going to drink a bottle of Canova Brook on your own, you're going to wait till some lovely friends come around. But you might. But we when we imagine it, somebody's, you know, just got engaged or somebody's just dropped around and you've got a bottle and it makes that moment of connection and human connection that much more special. And I know it's the very thing that I loved about my restaurant years. Is, you know, standing at the door, you know, at the desk of our restaurant, looking across a sea of heads in a busy restaurant with people laughing and getting on, it gives me goosebumps. It still does. And it's the same, that same feeling. Why is that so important? Well, it's the most base of human instincts, isn't it? To break bread together and to connect over food and wine. You know, for millennia, we've been doing it. And, you know, in a very, very small way, we're hoping that Canova Brook makes that happen. So it's all about connection.
And that connection, I mean, you were talking about keeping it local, your supply chain quite local.
Yeah.
How local is that? I mean, do you ship a, you know?
So we have two arrangements. One is with Liberty Wines, who were one of kind of my first ever suppliers to my first restaurant, David Gleave, set up by David Gleave, I think within a couple of weeks of us setting up Morrow. And so they distribute us nationwide. But we have an exclusion zone of 15 miles radius around the vineyard. And so we supply all, restaurants and particularly, again, independent off-licenses ourselves directly. And obviously, that it's easier when it's closer to have those kind of human connections. So we don't use a courier, we drop them around. We talk and we connect and we suggest things and we invite them, like we're hosting a big dinner tonight. Half of the people coming and our lovely suppliers locally. And just getting them involved in the story, getting them understanding the family nature of what we're doing, the kind of small scale of it, the, you know, the intention, that ethos I keep talking about, getting them to hear from us on that, you know, I think is a really big part of being able to enjoy the wine and for them to be able to communicate that to their customers. And so That's why I love the local, because it's so much easier to have that human connection back to connection again.
Yes.
But that human connection with the people that are selling it, that are representing it, or enjoying it.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, within a luxury framework, community, connectivity, local, all those things are so important, because there's opportunity to share in a way that you wouldn't be able to share if it were
yeah.
kind of a much wider
pool. Yeah. I think there's also a really interesting phenomena around the way you enjoy something, knowing the place from where it's come. And, you know, I remember, with food, you know, I never liked hot food until I went to Thailand and had it there. I didn't enjoy sherry until with Sam we would go down to Hareth and have it in situ. And suddenly, bam, you enjoy it in a different way. Languedoc wines and Minervois wines will always taste better to me because I've had an amazing walking holiday with my wife and some friends walking through that area. There is something in the appreciation of the area that enhances your enjoyment. I think that's really interesting. And again, it's to why I think, you know, our locals, our people that have been to the vineyard, who know the valley that we sit in, can understand and appreciate us in a different way.
It's interesting. I agree. Sushi in Japan doesn't taste like, you know, sushi doesn't taste, it doesn't matter where you go.
Yeah.
You can go to the finest sushi restaurant anywhere in the world, it still tastes better in the small
little
local sushi restaurant in Tokyo, wherever it might be. Okay, we'll move on.
That's good.
No, because I was thinking about, you know, how you personify luxury within the closeness of community,
yeah.
because often, people think that if something comes from Paris, it's going to be better.
Mm.
Or if something's coming from, if a burger is shipped in from New York or Kobe beef from Kobe,
right.
whatever, is better.
The provenance, So kind of provenance versus local.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's an interesting playoff because I sign up to both of those. Just because it's 5 miles down the road doesn't mean it's your best option.
No.
Even tomatoes, thinking entirely about their carbon footprint, can often have a smaller footprint coming from Spain because they've been grown outside rather than a heated greenhouse, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not, I think we become a little obsessed with local. I think there are times where it absolutely makes total sense, but I don't think it's above all else, because that the idea of place and provenance and understanding where it comes from, I think trumps that in a way. Appreciation that it comes from around the corner is one thing, but appreciation that, you know, this wonderful Serrano ham that's coming from the best, you know, yeah. parts of Andalusia, I think, and understanding how they go about, that, you know, feeding their, you know, the pigs, the acorns, etc. That, you know, that's a true appreciation of food and a product. I don't think it's local above all else.
No, and that's the grand tour, isn't it? I mean, you're finding the best from the place of origin often, but that's an interesting point you raise about local, you know, not always being the most sustainable and not always the best.
No.
And
I'm aware that it was. I mean, in a way, you know, the poor consumers forced to kind of get their head around so many different quandaries as far as seasonality and, you know, which fish is the sustainable, you know, most sustainable. Well, the answer is it depends from which fishery it's come, you know, what boat it's been caught by, you know, it's, and at which point they start tuning out. I mean, that was one of the reasons for the Sustainable Restaurant Association, actually, is to help navigate those complex issues. But I think, as a guide, the idea of transparency of provenance, I think, is the key, you know, understanding where it comes from. One of the things, repeating themes, particularly in conversations around the farm meetings we have, is decommoditizing the food that we're growing. Because at the moment, in most parts, the grains that we grow go into the same ships out of Southampton that our neighbours who couldn't give two hoots about regenerative farming go. And we go into that same pool and we get paid not a single premium, you know, by the grain dealers for doing going that extra mile. And so the idea of decommoditizing it, I think, is a really interesting one. We've got Andy Cato coming tonight from formerly Groove Armada, or still of Groove Armada, right, but also of Wild Farmed,
yeah,
who's a regen farmer himself, but a supremely gifted one, who's created a brand, Wild Farmed, which communicates all the ethos and principles that guide us, but is achieving a kind of recognition in the market that gets the farmer a premium. And so that's an example of how to decommoditize a food product in ways that rewards the right kind of farming kind of practice,
yeah,
which I think is really important. Doesn't happen enough, nothing like enough, but more of that, please, I'd say.
And what's the impact on blockchain?
Yeah, I remember when I first got my head around blockchain, whatever it was, 5 years ago, I thought, oh my goodness, here is a hugely important answer to that, yeah, to that quandary of provenance and traceability. And I have to say, unless I've just stopped, I mean, I'm now out of restaurants, so maybe I'm just not getting the memos, but I have not become aware of it being the game changer that it promised, yeah, to be 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So I don't feel qualified to comment, but other than kind of what happened. Maybe it's just all been getting on with, and it's gone kind of, it's getting baked in and we just don't realize. Yeah. But no, I mean... Yeah, I don't know.
Gone.
Yeah. NFTs. What happened to NFTs?
Yeah, exactly.
My wife wants to know, because she put $5,000 thinking this was the next best thing. I think it's disappeared.
Yeah, hopefully the $5,000's still there.
No, I don't think so. No, it's out in the ether and it's worth about £5.
So. Oh, right, okay. So Candover Brook, is an English sparkling wine. Where do you think this interest, and it's a growing interest in English wines, has come from? Because there seems to be increasing focus on the production of English sparkling wines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the quick and easy answer is to say from its extraordinary emerging quality. Mm. And you know, it was how many years ago that Hambledon wines beat all the major champagne houses in a kind of international competition, IWC, and got the headlines for doing so. But you know, there is a there's just this extraordinary emerging quality that I think it is, you know, impossible to ignore. And I guess what sits behind that, other than, you know, huge amount of investment that's going in, is the changing climate. Yeah. So we have a wonderful genius of a blender who spends most of the time in Champagne, Hervé Gestin, who's the most quiet, softly spoken genius you'll ever meet. So unprepossessing. And he actually worked with my dad in his first ever job about 40 years ago. He would blend Sainsbury's own label. And he said we're now harvesting here the same date they would harvest at the beginning of his career 40 years ago in Champagne. And conversely, in Champagne, they're now harvesting a month earlier. So that length of vine life for the grapes is everything. That's where the complexity and the diversity of flavor comes from, is that length. And if they've got, you know, they've got a month less, that's, you know, that's kind of 20%, 25% less complexity. And so no wonder the French champagne houses are buying up acres of Hampshire and Kent because they're running scared.
And that's quite a worry.
It's a worry not just for Champagne, but for the whole
for the globe. Yeah.
And you know, and I was saying last night, maybe the clever money is planting vines in Scotland, because you know, we are heading in one terrifying direction only, and that is towards climate catastrophe. And so, you know, much as I feel like we're sitting pretty here, you know, who knows in another 20 years? It's a rather sobering thought.
Yeah. And then one wonders why, I mean, that's a stupid question. One wonders why there's so much focus on encouraging people to consume more. I mean, I know it's about economics, but, you know, surely yeah. the reason...
We need a different model.
Yeah, these luxury brands yeah. is to reduce the amount I of know. Polyvinyls.
Yeah. Again, well, we're back to the bank managers, aren't we? You know, the finance yeah. houses and the investors, you know, try and explain to an investor why there's no dividend growth. It is our system, our model is broken, and yet, the incumbents don't seem in any way interested in shifting that. Mm-hmm. I was massively kind of impressed by the book, Donut Economics. I don't know yes. if you read it, but yeah. I found that so profoundly important in the way that it tries to describe an alternative model, and one, you know, I pray we are able to embrace before it's too late.
Yeah.
Although, don't hold your breath.
No, exactly. Well, we're not going to be around for to see the outcome. I don't know if that's fortunate or unfortunate. I wanted to ask you about technology and how you know what role technology plays in all the work you do, you know, whether it's the farming, the philanthropic work you do.
I mean, it's there. I get excited about the kind of interplay or the kind of the contrast between, you know, our obsession with tradition and you know, and the respect for the kind of artisanal mindset of the craft of it. Which feels to me, you know, really a kind of, you know, the opposite of the technology, and then you know that interplay with, you know, the cutting edge technology, and I you know there's an interesting tension there, and you know they both play a role. To think of examples, I guess, in the wider farm, it is increasingly all about the data. Right. And so, you know, our tractors are satellite tracked. We drill our seed according to the kind of heat maps of from the last year's harvest of what and vary the amount we drill, the amount we spray according, you know, to that square meter of soil. We do our soil analysis and sap analysis from the plant sap to work out what the plant is able to take up, because we've learned that there is a big difference between the nutrients that are in the soil and those that the plant are able to access, and that's a huge learning, because it's down to soil biology that they can be there, but if the plant itself can't absorb it, it relies on that dance I keep talking about that between the microbes and the fungi and the plant. And so we're running, you know, hugely kind of technologically advanced tests on a regular basis of our crops like that. And likewise in the vineyard, we're doing the same soil analysis and sap testing to learn the same lessons. I was up last week, was it? Week before, to Nottingham. My daughter's just finishing her finals up there, having done product design. And I took the occasion to go visit an amazing kind of world-leading research centre that is part of the University of Nottingham on soil structure. Well, the science of soil.
Yeah.
And they showed me round, and their extraordinary kit where they are using kind of 3D x-rays, analyzing the importance and trying to understand the importance of soil structure and the science of interconnectedness of soil and as a proxy for soil health, I thought was fascinating. Yeah, the technological kind of attitude, I mean, or understanding of soil, you know, and we're just scratching the surface, you know, in terms of that understanding and the myriad of processes that go on. We've become, we hosted my sister and I with Gatsby, which is another of the Sainsbury Family Trust, hosted a conference, 2-day conference up in Cambridge at the Sainsbury Plant Science Lab, beginning of March. And with the kind of almost the sole intention of bringing these three disparate communities together from whom each other has so much to learn. And that was the plant scientists, who obsess about tiny processes within the mitochondria of a cell, and dedicate their entire careers to this one process, and the soil scientists, who think about the world completely different. It's not the reductionist plant science mindset, but this systems thinking, and the third party being the regen farmers. And there was just this extraordinary coming together of understanding and appreciation in ways that you just rarely see. They live in such different silos that they rarely hear from the other. And to hear stories from the field of the extraordinary success that the likes of Craig at our farms and others are enjoying, for reasons that I reckon the scientists can't explain entirely, and the need for those scientists to redirect their attentions to the dance, as I call it, and that extraordinary interplay between the symbiotic relationships that go on in a fully functioning soil. It was really exciting, actually. And there are conversations that are now going forward from that conference that just would never have happened, and research budgets being redirected in ways, that we could have only just hoped for. It's extraordinary. But slightly off your question, but the idea that research and technology is at the heart of what we're trying to do, yes. And really, in some ways, in just trying to make the case and understand what we're experiencing, because we're doing it anyway, and actually the kind of science in a way needs to catch up.
Yeah. And how widespread do you think this kind of knowledge transfer will extend?
Will go, yeah. So it has the bell curve of adoption. And so we're in the foothills of that.
Right.
We're still at the kind of early adopter stage where, we're at the vanguard, we're in the vanguard, but I would have thought, maybe 20% of UK farms are doing regen in its entirety, in its pillars. But I think, I would imagine 80% of farmers are doing some aspects of regen. So, whereas 5 years ago, it felt like a quirky, slightly hippie thing to be thinking about and doing, it has gone mainstream, helped in large part actually by the Ukraine war, which saw the price of fertilizer go up, whatever it was, five times.
Yeah.
And suddenly, die-in-the-wall kind of intensive farmers were knocking at our doors, asking how on earth it is we've reduced by 70% our nitrogen applications, etc. And that helped focus the mind. But I think, yeah, it has gone. It's gone mainstream already. It there's a way to go. Farmers and I think more maybe than winemakers are a pretty conservative lot.
Yeah.
I think there's it's one of the benefits of this newly emerging English wine scene is that it's not burdened with the same traditions of the old world, the French appellation system, that we can experiment and innovate. We can try things out and walk away from them if they fail in ways that kind of more established wine regions, I don't think, can.
So there's this biodynamic approach, isn't there? Can you explain?
No, I can't. What goes on?
Yeah.
No, so we don't call our wine biodynamic,
right,
because we don't adopt every last of the many principles that lie behind it, and nor am I any great expert.
Right.
But Hervé, who I've referenced earlier, he is a huge believer in it, and when our winemaker Hambledon were designing their winery. It was done very much in the principles of biodynamics. So there's no pumping, it's all gravity fed. So it's because the electric fields that surround, electric pumps affect the flavor profiles.
Yeah.
So Hervé says, and the key moment for us as far as biodynamics is in the blending.
Right.
So, and we just a few weeks ago, Hervé came over from France, and with him he brings what I think of as his kind of water diviner rods, which are kind of two metal rods. And as we sit there, we've got 18 different I guess, you know, wine tanks to still wines to blend with from of the different varieties, the different clones, the cuvée and the Thai, the kind of the first pressings and the later pressings, and so they're kind of like paints on a on an artist easel, right? And so and it's the art behind that is obviously to choose the right mix, and so to and it can take forever. So instead, what Alvy does with his little diviner rods, which are very much the biodynamic, measuring the reverberations of right. the different wines, is predict the compatibility of the different wines. So he will get our base sorted, and to which we want to add different elements. And before he pours it in and tastes, he will get his divining rods out and see what how the gauge moves. And do not ask me what the heck is going on there, because I have not a clue. But he was a man at 40 years experience of blending wines who absolutely swears blind that it is absolutely the way to go. And, you know, he is revered within the world of champagne for his skills. So I'm not one to argue.
Right.
And I, you know, I've experienced it. I, you know, I've said, come on, that was good. I really want to try those two together. Can we at least try? I know your meter says no, but can we try it? Sure enough, it's like, yeah, not so much. It didn't really work. So, and we did that two or three times, and every time it's like, wow, no, weird. I love that mystery, actually. Yeah. Were it all boiled down to the science, I think it would be a rather boring process. But here is this rather magical kind of process of alchemy that goes on that I think makes it wonderful thing.
And that's the luxury and the connoisseur, isn't it?
I guess it is. You know, it's that artisanal, just kind of the craft of it. It's just like that. We rely, and I am not one of them, we rely on these brilliant minds, these creative geniuses to help us in our projects it's one of the great joys. Like I was saying, you know, sitting there with your architect or your interior designer or Hervé with his blending, to be with him in a spirit of collaboration. He's not one just to tell us. He, you know, brings it out of you. What do you want? And he, you know, it's that rapport that builds up over time, that conversation, that collaboration that I love. That's the essence of the joy that comes from the project for me.
Wow. I'm interested, what drives you, Mark?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I think my first thing that springs to mind is how that drive has changed, one's motivation. I kind of referred to it briefly earlier.
Yeah.
Because definitely I was showing off to my parents and my friends in the early stages of my life, right? That I wanted to prove, you know, my dad's a hugely successful man, brilliant at not actually loading us with too much kind of fear trying to keep up with him. Never played that game. But obviously, like my siblings, I was keen to impress him and my mum. Yeah. And so there was a bit of that going on early on in my career, definitely. And the approval and of my friends, I think, then, and trying to, you know, and my contemporaries. But it was very, I think maybe in my 40s, that kind of started to fall away in this sense that actually it's more about legacy and the principles that guide one, and that actually doing the right thing and being true to your own principles trumped everything. And so it was less about how big and how far and how successful. It was more, how much value can you bring? How much... how much integrity and authenticity do you bring? And how much pride can you have in what it is that you do? And so I think that is taking pride in what we do and finding joy in that process that's the driver for me.
Great. Innovation or craftsmanship or both for you?
Oh, it's got to be an and, not an or. I don't like ors.
Okay.
I'd go and. It's them both. And that interplay between the two, I like that tension that can build. Between the tradition, we've always done it this way, but what if we try it another way? I love that tension and those conversations.
Okay. And finally, what is your luxury?
Oh, crikey. We're just going on the first thing that springs to my mind, it's my Santa Cruz rear suspension mountain bike, which I spent more money on than I've ever spent on a bike in my life, and it brings me more joy and pleasure bouncing around the Highlands of Scotland or the valleys of Hampshire than any sports car could So yeah, no, it's that, it's, yeah, it's my really fancy mountain bike.
Brilliant. Mark Sainsbury, thank you so much for joining us on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. We hope to see you next time.